Our egos don't take us anyplace meaningful and can often give us a victim mindset. But choosing courage over confidence can make all the difference. Therefore, tune into this compelling episode and discover how leadership expert Adrian Kaler shows you how to speak and listen for unprecedented results. Hey everyone, welcome to the Forge by Trust podcast. I'm your host, Robin Dreek, professional speaker, executive coach, former U.S. Marine, spy recruiter, best-selling author, and your trust and communication expert. Coming up next on the Forge by Trust podcast.
If you call people into courageous action and get them to act out of their best self instead of their kind of practiced mediocre self, over time it's like, okay, I'm actually this guy. I'm that one. I'm not going to go back to who I was before. And that's leadership transformation.
Welcome to the Forge by Trust podcast. My name is Robin Dreek, and I'm honored to be your host. I bring a wealth of experience and expertise to the table as an FBI spy recruiter, professional speaker, executive coach, former U.S. Marine, best-selling author, and most importantly, your trust and communication expert. The Forge by Trust podcast is a show where we explore the essential skill of forging trust for building an innovative culture and exceptional leadership. Join us as we delve into the behavior skills and communication techniques required for success and learn from the best in the industry. Our guests include spies, spy recruiters, master interrogators, best-selling authors, thought leaders, and innovators who will share their insights on building teams, partnerships, and exceptional leadership by forging trust. As your host, a global behavior expert and master spy recruiter, I will guide you through the process of building authentic connections based on trust. Stop settling for less and learn how to master communication skills you need to move beyond transactional relationships and into mutually beneficial collaboration and partnerships. Whether you're a student, entrepreneur, C-suite executive, or parent, forging trust is the key to unlocking your potential. Today's episode, Naked Leadership, is with my good friend, Adrian Kaler. Adrian Kaler is a leadership engagement expert and senior partner at the executive coaching firm Take New Ground. He coaches executives and entrepreneurs in the art and science of leadership for themselves, their teams, and clients to create new, unprecedented results and experience fulfillment in their work. He is the co-host of the engaging podcast, The Naked Leadership Podcast, with Take New Ground senior partner, Dan Tocchini. During the episode today, we talk about choosing courage over confidence, loving and thriving in chaos, from a victim to a responsible mindset, calling people to courageous action, speaking and listening for unprecedented results. I'm almost speechless starting off, Adrian. All I can do is say thank you so much for entering my life and the audience's life and being part of the podcast, and welcome to Forge by Trust.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here, Robin. Thanks for having me, man. Getting to know you.
Oh, and likewise. And the most profound thing we really do as human beings is make deep, deep connections. And it's the most challenging thing to do in our world. And I don't care about your economic status, social status, whatever orientation, all these different things in the world. It's very challenging for any human being to make a deep connection and have ultimate, unwavering trust.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought I'd just kick off our conversation with one question, and that is, when you were growing up, those things we experience kind of forge and begin that thread that follows through us in life. And I'm just curious, what do you think it was when you were younger that kind of sparked that passion and that life's calling to make a human connection, to be of service to others, and ultimately become the great coach that you are?
A great question. And I think the natural orientation of my work is all so future oriented, and I don't do a lot of reflection on questions like this. So it's always refreshing to think about it. And the past is always a little bit mysterious, I think, as well. You know, what got me into it? I was crafted by two impeccable human beings, my parents. Today is actually their 49th anniversary today.
Oh, that is beautiful. What a perfect timing, isn't it?
It is beautiful. And they're wonderful humans, both of them public school teachers, both of them, you know, of service in the community. Both of them have a vibrant faith life and have been in service in the church context and whatever. Anyway, and I grew up small town America.
Where did you grow up, Adrian?
I grew up in Salem, Illinois, which is like 70 miles east of St. Louis, Missouri. 8,000 people when everybody's home. You know, it was quaint. It was great. It was really great. Sports town. My dad was like the coach teacher guy. So they taught, I mean, they've got quite the legacy. There's not really a person in Salem that either wasn't taught by one of them or both of them, or their kids or their even other grandkids were taught by. I mean, sometimes they taught all three generations. They would teach three generations. Like they teach a kid when they first got started and then their kid and then their kids. So our point here is like, what compelled me? I saw it in action. Number one, both of my parents were about people and about service in the community.
And how did that come about? I mean, what was their things that they crafted? Did you use that word crafted? It's a beautiful word to talk about, kind of an intentional way to go about life.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what was going on for them before I came around, except for that they, you know, they just wanted to be teachers. They loved teaching. They loved investing in kids. And
what did they teach?
My mom taught fifth grade most of her career, and she was impeccable, impeccable as a teacher. Everybody's favorite teacher. If you went to their little, she would taught a smaller rural school.
What do you think made her so likable and beloved by the kids?
She really loved the kids, like loved them, like, and especially loved the troublemakers. I mean, she would put, you know, any of these kids that were from tougher backgrounds and were squirrely and or had broken families and then were squirrely, you know, because all that stuff's just symptoms, like kids sure. acting out is just a symptom. So she would put them right next to her and she would just convince them, hey, we're going to be close friends now. And so that's part of it. Deep love, like really deep commitment to the kids. And then also she ran her classroom like she was a, you know, captain of a ship. Like you didn't mess around in Miss Kaler's class. So, and I remember I was probably 15 or 16. I went out to visit her. Maybe I was coming back from college, actually. I haven't thought about this in a long time. I think I was actually coming back from college. So I was probably 18 or 19. I came back to go visit her, maybe surprise visit her school. And I heard her, and I walked into the school and I heard her voice. And instead of going in, I just sat by the door. The door was closed, but I could hear her. And I just marveled in her presence in the classroom of deep command for, of course, you know, the curriculum and such, but deep command is a presence. And then just love. And she was on the move and just flowed so well with the chaos of a fifth grade classroom. So she taught fifth grade and she was impeccable. My dad was a freshman history teacher, the most beloved teacher at the high school. Number one reason, he never gave homework. Everybody loved that. But he was just a storyteller and he'd just talk all day long and tell stories and make everything really relevant and light and fun. And then tell you how to pass all the tests and kind of got the fact that like the interaction is the point, not the test, the interaction around the content, around the ideas. That was the point. And so, and they just loved, my dad had a heart for the outsiders always. Like it's in some ways similar to my mom now that I'm thinking about it. Like there's nobody that didn't love my dad.
So this is really fascinating. These threads that start in our lives start with their parents, and there's a thread that started in their lives. What do you think was their spark to do this? Because they obviously had a lot of reps and the flow that you're talking about how your mother, you could hear her commanding and just maneuvering in that classroom. That sounds like it was something she was inspired to do as well. How did she come to want to do that? And your dad too?
Well, my mom, both of them have a rich faith life. They do. And I think a lot of that comes from that, like making a difference with other people was core. My mom, it was truer for her at a much younger age around her own mission in life, which was to serve people, love people.
Where was her exposure to that? Where did that come from? Her parents?
She grew up in like a church environment, like pretty conservative Southern Baptist environment. And she was just convinced that like this narrative was the one that mattered the most, like helping put the world back together, you know, like helping people. Everybody's messed up at some level and we all need something. And for her, much more sense that that's a God conversation and that there's nobody too far from the love and the grace of God. And that was always really compelling to her. And she was also kind of the no BS person too. She'd shoot you straight. Like, so it wasn't like everybody needs a hug. Some people need a slap upside the head,
right?
You know? And she was the disciplinarian of the two of them, you know? Right. So she was, you know, to get that look off your face or I'll slap it off kind of person, you know, and she was the tough lover of the two of them. So I, you know, and her, she was a mix of her parents, right? So her dad was the sweetest pie, you know, he'd grow a garden just to give it all away. That type of guy.
Wow.
Simple guy, got one of eight kids in even more rural Illinois. And her mom was tough. Her mom was like the strict one, the disciplinarian one as well. So, I mean, she saw that and it worked for her and very tied to her own kind of life mission.
Right.
And I think, you know, and I'm a pretty competitive person. I think, you know, both my parents are pretty competitive as well. I mean, in her little school, there was like two fourth grade classes and two sixth grade classes, but she'd take them all. They'd put them all under her. So it's probably a little bit of joy and like making, you know, being, you know, top of class.
Sure. So here you are back then, you have these great role models.
Great role models.
That are, like you said, crafting you and crafting the world around them. So did you have any kind of spark or knowledge of a path you wanted to start walking back then?
Well, I knew that I was interested. I was naturally fascinated with how people work only because when I turned, I don't know, 15, I started asking a lot of questions that I didn't have a lot of people around me that seemed to be asking that. I was a troubled kid. I wasn't troubled in lots of maybe scary ways. I was just really curious and wanted to know how stuff worked. Like, how does this work? Like, how do like relationships work? Hold on a second. Like, how does this thing, and what am I supposed to do? And it's like always spinning with really inquiry, I guess, but also a little bit anxious about it, you know, on the inside, outside, you know, kept pretty poised, right. But internally always really working something over. And for whatever reason, like was troubled with how good something could get.
Do you remember what that was? What the first relationship is that you were asking yourself that question on?
That's a fun question. I mean, this is something I've thought about in a long time. I remember being in sixth grade and sitting at a basketball game. And I don't remember the girl's name, but there was a girl sitting next to me that I wanted to talk to. And I'm just thinking, what do I say to a girl?
Right.
What do I do? You know? And I remember it was about that time I had my first girlfriend and I thought, oh, you talked to him on the phone. I would like sit there and have notes.
Right.
Total nerdball. I'd make a list of topics to talk about. And then I'd call her. Her name was Rihanna. And I'd call her and we'd talk about these topics, you know, and it's like, what do I talk about? It's like the neighbors, the dog, my favorite food, her favorite food. And I'm just thinking, is this what you talk about? Is this like you set an agenda for a six-year-old sixth grade conversation with a girlfriend? So around that time is when I, you know, started like getting anxious, I guess as teenage angst or whatever.
Sure.
And, you know, it was really internal for me. Like, you know, my parents were phenomenal. There's a lot of this was going on behind the scenes for me. And I think that's when I started studying and really started studying leadership at the time too, because I would just be in any environment and just kind of naturally doing the math on, okay, who's in charge here? How'd they get in charge? What do they do that keeps them in charge? Who should he not be in charge anymore? And then who's, you know, I was always just thinking about group dynamics. And my parents weren't sitting me down and teaching me about group dynamics. I just found that fascinating and became interested in leadership in some ways because I was always uncomfortable if a moment wasn't being led well.
Hmm.
Like moments of chaos or moments of transition or, you know, moments of change or whatever, or moments of question or what, anything that's going on. I was always paying attention to who's in charge, what should we be doing now? And then I realized early that whoever's in charge is for the most part appoints themselves. I mean, maybe it's a teacher student and that the teacher's in charge and the rest of the students, but who's the leader of the students? Who, you know, that's not a role somebody gives to you. That's the role you choose for yourself. And I realized that practicing being a leader was always up for grabs and the world needs team captains and you can either wait and be picked or you can just pick yourself. And so early in life, I just started picking myself. Like we're on the recess or we're doing whatever and we got 30 minutes to play basketball. And the best way to do this is to get set up in teams. And we need two captains. I'm the first one. And then Tom, you're the second captain. Let's go. And then just, I found that that was a way to, in some ways, deal with my internal angst on how do we make the most out of a moment, make the most out of an opportunity. There's got to be a leader and might as well be me.
Do you remember the first time you did it?
That first time I did it. Wow. Do I remember the first time I did it? Vivid memories of third grade.
Wow, it's early.
Yeah. Vivid memories of third grade, me and Nathan and Blake. And we just would set up camp in the four square. We'd set up camp. And the Three Musketeers, we called ourselves. I haven't thought about that in a long time. But
how is do you remember how the behavior was rewarded back then that kind of set it in you, like this is the way to work?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we then in like, I don't know, adolescent vernacular, like we became the cool kids.
Right.
I guess that was, I mean, whatever. My parents were, I had decent clothes and whatever, right. Smart, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, people just became attracted to you because you held something, you held influence. And, and people that want to follow, if not lead, and, you know, became this one of those guys that was like calling the shots. And it then, I mean, a significant probably shift for me, because that's kind of like leadership in action. And right. I got how that worked. And that there was also leadership in relationship. And at some point pretty early, you're going to ask me when the first time it was, I'll think about that because I know the question that's coming after this. But at some point really early, people started coming to me to talk about stuff where it's like away from the crowd, they would have questions or have troubles or have challenges. And I didn't know it why at the time. I was just the guy right. that people would come and talk to. And I don't know exactly when that started.
What made them think that you were the guy? What were they seeing when they saw you?
I think I've had this aspect of myself where I tend to be really loving and accepting, and at the same point, pretty directive.
Were you curious about them as well?
Yeah. Like, and when I say loving and accepting, I'm just like, you can tell me anything and that's great. Like I'm not going to judge you and tell me how that works and why is it that way? And is it worse than that? Just go ahead and tell me if it's worse. It's okay. Like, you know, it's like safe space to let people be themselves.
You made them feel safe.
Yeah. Made them feel safe. Like, hey, it's cool. Whatever you got to say, I'm your guy. Like if you need to get something off your chest, get it off with me. It's cool, man.
Right.
And I usually ask the extra question that most people wouldn't. You know, it's like somebody says something and, you know, revealing, you know how this is anywhere in life. It's like when somebody says something real, people get nervous because they don't know what to do about that or feel like they need to fix it or feel like they, you know, or maybe it hits something deep within them that makes them uncomfortable. And so they don't want to talk about it. I would tend to like ask a lot of follow-up questions about how that works for them. And hold on, you know, like get into the details. Partially because I was really curious about me and about them and how that worked. And life was like a constant experiment to me of existence. Existence was a kind of fascinating game. But yeah, I think I made them feel really safe and I helped them make good choices. You know, like there's lots of parallels between what I do now, but help them really find out like what's authentic for them. Like, what do you really want, man? I know this is the pressure that's going on over here, but what do you want? I know your mom's saying that this as a kid, like, I know your mom's saying that, or, you know, this guy's saying this, but what do you really want? Why don't you just do what you want to do? You know, like that type of advocacy for people. But yeah, that was like early, especially I grew up in that faith conversation and adopted that early, just socialized in that way, probably. And then, you know, had my own early high school days. I was like, forget that. And did the whole sex, drugs, rock and roll thing that most high schoolers do. And some people never stop doing, but that didn't satisfy me. Like the whole, like, finding new ways to escape. That didn't really satisfy me. And then I came back to a really authentic faith pursuit, but wasn't very religious, right. Meaning would read the old scriptures and stuff and really try to get the themes of it and then go practice being that theme, you know, instead of like memorizing and being the smart guy or being some dogmatic religious dude. I never was interested in that. I was interested in the way of being of these, you know, ancient patterns of thought and behavior and language that actually helped you generate a lot of life inside and outside. So mid high school, I'd already done the whole sex, drugs, rock and roll thing, decided to give that up, but I was still part of the in crowd. So I'd go to all the parties and I just wouldn't drink.
Right.
And then I'd just be the guy hanging out in the kitchen, because that's where everybody goes at a party. I'd hang out in the kitchen and I'd just talk to people. And I'd sit and talk to, you know, somebody for 2 hours at a party around life stuff. And I loved it. I loved it because it's like, oh, these folks are, I mean, we're all having a good time and I'm having a great time. And we're all dying to have another deeper conversation. And there was always, you know, in my family, I was always like the deep one, which wasn't like a term of endearment. It was like, hey, man, why don't you just relax? And I always just watch Wheel of Fortune. But I always wanted to talk about the deep stuff. You know, I put that in quotes, deep. It's like, for me, it's like fun stuff. Like, let's get beyond the surface and talk about what's really going on. Because I've got a lot of thoughts and got a lot of questions and got a lot of, you know, pain and whatever and figuring this out. And I've got lots of passions and pursuits. And can we just talk about that instead of what happened in the Rams game? And so, anyway, that really mid high school is when that started to concrete for me that I just kind of liked the deep end.
Was there a defining time, or maybe there wasn't, that you went from kind of that, it sounded almost like social anxiety from not quite sure how to talk to a girl or someone else to the supreme confidence? I don't know if you felt confident at the time, but this, we'll call it more of an ability to communicate like you were in these situations.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely became a practice for me where in the most environments, I just decided to step out. And so, you know, so I would, and still to this day, I bank on courage over confidence every day. So, cause for me, confidence is ROI, like, right. you know, but if you take what's accessible always is courage, and that just takes guts. And do I have the guts to do it? Do I have the guts to say even now, if I'm sitting in a boardroom with a whole bunch of really smart people and there's like a conversation they're obviously not wanting to have, am I willing to go have that conversation? Or if there's a jerk in the room that nobody's talking to and everybody's talking around, let's just talk about that. Hey man, what's up with you and your attitude? I'm dying to know and we can move on, but you seem really upset, like constantly since I've met you, you've seemed upset. Why do you like being so upset? Let's talk about that. Anyway,
love that question. That is so good.
Yeah. Why do you like being upset, man? What's up with this?
Make them own it.
Come on, dude. Like, it's not like it's an accident. You love being upset. No, I don't. Well, I don't know. Let's look at your life for a minute. Like, what percentage of your work life do you spend being upset? And let's say that's not an accident. What are the potential upsides to being the upset person? There's a long list of payoffs to being the upset person. Let's at least name them.
Right.
And then let's get clear about the prices you pay and other people pay for being the upset person, because it's just a persona. It's just a game you're playing. You might think it's you, but I'm not Freud. I don't think this is you. I think this is just a strategy that you've used to survive. Right. So, but let's talk about the future that comes with you being disgruntled guy. Anyway, I tended to appoint myself, it might sound weird saying this, but I tended to just want to be the courageous guy. And just step up. So when, hey, do we have a volunteer? Yep, I'll go. Hey, who's going to go do this? I will. And I just wanted to, I remember in high school, it was a thing for me. Although I was the quarterback of the football team and dating the chick and blah, 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 student council, blah, blah, blah. There was an aspect of me where I had, this is going to sound weird to say this stuff out loud, but I knew that was power. That was opportunity and that was influence. And there was a part of me that knew that I really wanted to befriend people that most of the people in my kind of class of, you know, because I was kind of in the smart kids and the jocks and blah, blah, blah. there's certain people that most of those folks in my different pockets, natural pockets, they didn't talk to. And I just wanted to go talk to them. And that's probably the faith conversation for me, just because right. not to evangelize at all, because whatever, believe whatever you want to believe. But I dug that about the, at least the image and the metaphor of, or the person of Jesus, that he tended to go for the outsider and talk to people that nobody else talked to. And that was really compelling for right. me. It's like, wow, that's really fucking cool to go break the rules, the social rules, for the sake of love. That's cool. And that seems like that's not what normal humans do.
Right.
And I'd love to be abnormal. So let me right. go practice that, you know? And so I had collected a whole bunch of friends, and I just loved going down the halls and like giving high fives to some of the people that would get neglected or not ignored most of their lives. And that was really, obviously there's big ROI in that for me, because it feels good.
Right.
It feels good to make a difference to people. But I knew it made a huge difference in them, huge oh, yeah. for them, because I was like vouching for them and, hey, come sit at our table, come sit down, you know, like that kind of, and that was fun. And I knew I was being an example, and I liked that. That feels good to be the example. So, I mean, I was always also a teenager that was a jerk at times and, you know, blah, blah, like there's lots of, I'm not going to paint a picture like I'm like some kind of walking on water. That was definitely not the case.
Right.
But, you know, but there was a striving there that meant a lot to me.
So we had a lot of positive reinforcement over these behaviors at a young age. What was next after high school?
Yeah, went on to play. I was athletic enough and worked hard enough to go play football in college.
Where'd you go?
I went to Millikan University, small school in Illinois. I didn't think I'd get a shot. My brother was like the more natural and the bigger athlete of the two of us, and I was kind of the runt. Uh-huh. But I did work really hard, and that compensated.
And how many
that.
Siblings?
Just two of us, me and my older brother. He's okay. 3 years older, and he was the hoss, we would have called him in our vernacular. Right. Big dude. He was the linebacker and the home run hitter and the left-handed pitcher. Right. He was the total package. It worked out that I kind of got all my delinquency, most of my delinquency out of my, did that early in high school. So in the last couple of years of high school, I was actually focused and after it. So went on to Millikan, was like, I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. I was like a pre-med major. I thought I'd go be a doctor, that kind of thing, just because I took all the, every life science course there was, and just loved that. And I like memorizing stuff and total nerd ball in that way. So I thought I might want to be a doctor. So I was like pre-med. And then I realized pretty early in my college career, I didn't want to do that. I just so happened to have a roommate that was, his dad was an RN in Gary, Indiana, like dealing with some heavy duty stuff, which sounded pretty fun to go get in the mix of some chaos. So actually shifted over and became a nursing major. So I was like football player / nursing major.
So in the mess of chaos, what was our draw to be in the midst of chaos like that, do you think?
It just sounded fun, man. I don't know if it's like growing up on Indiana Jones or whatever, but just like being a part of an adventure. And and I think it's the competitive edge in me, like going places nobody else wants to go or nobody else is willing to go. It's like that kind of take a risk and feel alive type thing, and maybe like partially being a thrill seeker. But I made up that was heroic to go do that kind of work too. So it's like ROI on your life. Like, you know, you can go fit in or you can go stand out, and that the standing out's going to feel better. So anytime
you put yourself out there to the extreme that you were, even at a young age, did it cause any humbling moments along the way that you learned something profound from?
Yes. Let's see where.
Anything that reeled you in?
Yeah. I'm just thinking about what those might have been. I mean, so profound moments for me, just getting flashes in my mind around different scenarios. And I'm connecting all these dots that I haven't. Yeah. So thanks for the great conversation. I liked being involved in disparate groups, and I kind of became good at being a part of this nursing cohort, and there's like two dudes in the whole program. Right. And then, you know, being a part of the football team, which is like, obviously, all dudes. And like the being able to make a bridge between those two communities or like represent both to the other, that was pretty profound. Or you know, even just being a freshman in college and, you know, they have like a spring break program where you're like going out and doing a service project, which was compelling to me based on some of my history. And I jumped in and my team leader left. And so all of a sudden they said, Adrian, would you lead the thing? And I'm like a freshman leading now a group of upperclassmen to go do a thing in Denver. And, you know, the profound moment was, which I guess I don't usually talk about so much my faith-based background, but there's an old passage that says, don't let them look down on you because you're young, but set an example for them in life and love and speech and faith and purity. That's in a letter that between a mentor and a mentee from, right, you know, 2000 years ago. But that whole idea, like, don't let them look down on you because you're young. That, you know, I realized that to be so, like, who cares? Like, life, like, maturity isn't connected to chronology. Like, you can become mature really early if you want to. Like, you can become wise really early if you want to. You can have, you know, we haven't gotten to all my story yet, but usually when I tell people about all my different career changes, they're like, oh, you've lived a handful of lives. And that's so, just because I've decided to just go after what was appealing to me and what mattered to me. And there's like through lines, yeah, about what makes that work. But, you know, like, who cares? Like, the status quo is pretty boring. And yeah.
And to have this kind of success in anything we do in life, it's maintaining the most challenging balance of all is the dichotomy of confidence with humility.
Right.
Obviously, you had a lot of confidence in all you're doing because you were constantly being validated that your methodology is working.
Yeah.
Any idea how you're able to maintain that humility along the way? Because you obviously were doing it well.
Well, because I've blown it a ton. You know, even just this morning, I was on the call with a client that I'd sent to a contractor of ours, and he blew it. And there was some accounting that I needed to do about how I wasn't paying attention to my client, like I could have been. And it wasn't like I did anything wrong. I just didn't pay attention to what was right.
Right.
And, you know, I'm on that call and I'm saying, man, you're totally right. I missed it. It's just on me. There's no excuse. There's no reason. I missed it. And, you know, sought forgiveness for that. And I've needed to do that and want to do that, just because I get that the ego takes me nowhere meaningful. It takes people lots of places successful, but I don't want success without meaning. And having a clear conscience is a huge part of meaning.
Yeah.
So anytime, you know, when I blow it, I want to go make it right away. And I want to own my shit and shut my mouth and just listen and learn. So yeah, that's how the way I think about humility is, I mean, I think colloquially, humility is about not being too big in your own eyes, which I think is really true.
Right.
And humility is also about being right size, like really owning what you bring to the table. Like, that's also a part of humility. And I do that in a way to like be of service to people.
Right.
So acting small doesn't do anybody else favors either. So for me, in the humility conversation, I want to really own what's true, which is like, I have a ton to bring and I can be unapologetic about that. And I've got a ton to learn and I want to be really unapologetic about that. So it's like this both and tension that's never going to go away. And I want to really be both, you know? And so if I blow it, I want to own it quickly. Like I did this morning with my wife when I, you know, reacted poorly when I'm trying to get the kids out the door and she's bringing up something that I wish she wasn't bringing up and it's slowing down the process. And I, you know, got defensive and, you know, and she texted me on the way when I'm on the way to school. And I just said, you are totally right. I am so sorry. And nice. I wanted to argue and make sure she knew my point. But no, man, shut your mouth. She's right.
Own it, right?
Own it. And when I got home, came, gave her a kiss, said, hey, you know what? Here's what was going on for me, and I was wrong. Would you forgive me? And I want that to be more and more of a practice. I mean, I don't know. I'm 42 now. So the good thing is that happens quicker now than it did when I was 32. So anyway, I just want to live in both of those dichotomies. Yeah.
That's great balance and sounds like you're doing it phenomenally because owning it's everything.
I'm really committed to it. And that's for sure.
So what's next after college?
Oh yeah. So did college, got a nursing degree, and dating a girl in Chicago, moved to Chicago.
And what was your specialty for nursing?
Well, out of college, it was nothing. I went and studied, I applied for 4 jobs in Chicago. There weren't many men in my profession. Thanks. You know, what was it? Meet the parents. Anyway, you easily get a job if you're a dude. We were 12% of the field and I interview well. So I got 4 offers and I fell in love with this children's hospital. So up in Chicago, there was a children's hospital. Loved that. Loved the spirit of the place and fell in love with the mission. You know, it's like, if a kid's sick, what matters more than like sustaining a kid who's like got 70 years ahead of them, like that are, and got a family that's like freaking out naturally having the worst day of their lives. And if you can step into that room and ground the room, educate the room, pull the room together, create fun and joy in the midst of chaos and tragedy, that sounded like a fun game to me. So I took a job at Children's Memorial and I ended up getting, they didn't let many new grads like me be part of what they called their resource team, which was, I was a utility player. I could work on every floor. And this was like, the regional hospital, right? So it's the top hospital in the Midwest.
Yeah.
We were ranked number 4 in the nation at the time, but I got to work on every floor and be trained by the best of every floor, which was awesome. And the best of the best worked in the PICU. So I ended up focusing in the pediatric intensive care, which was just, once again, the highest stakes game there. And if you get really good at that, you could do everything else, right? That's the toughest stuff. So, and I cared about the relational side of the work. I cared about the spiritual side of the work, which is mostly around relationships anyway.
Right.
And so, started writing, articles for the nursing newsletter around how to build rapport with people, how to de-escalate, quote unquote, crazy parents, how to, speak and to instruct doctors on how to do their job better, because we need them to do their job so we could do our job. And anyway, the interpersonal dynamics of making it work was really fascinating to me. And I at least had something to say about it. So I started writing and doing that part of it. And I loved it. And it was great. And it was thrilling. At the same time, I was very involved in the faith world and involved in a church there. And long story short, I was with a team over in India doing some service projects as a way to prep for that trip. They gave us this talk, think of like a TED talk, I guess, for those listening, and of this guy that was out in LA that talked about faith in the most dynamic way I'd ever heard, and moved out to LA and become an intern at this church. So I kept up the nursing side and then also pursued my love of meaning, love of mission, love of human development and leadership development at this church called Mosaic, which is a pretty well-known church at the time, about 3,000 people in the city of LA. Those kind of big churches only happen in the suburbs usually, but this guy was compelling and world-renowned in his authorship and speaking, and just a prophetic voice, like in the sense that I could translate big concepts to the ground in such a compelling way. He just became a mentor of mine. His name is Erwin. And I did that. I did that for a good while. And they asked me to set up and do what I love doing, which is activism type work and standing up for the poor and the marginalized and helping, all that kind of stuff. And so I built a whole network for us between us and the city and the county and all these nonprofits and mobilized about 2,000 people a year to go make a difference. And so like pulling together a volunteer army to go give their time, give their money to go help somebody that, may never say thank you. That was a fun venture. So did that. Out of that, a guy that I just helped in his own spiritual journey, his father was a billionaire. So he was a millionaire. And he said, hey, would you help me give my money away? So I left Mosaic to go set up a foundation for him and helped him figure out what he wanted to do. So I took him around the world and introduced him to all the nonprofits that I knew and the missions that I knew and the issues and all the challenges, social ills that needed help. And we ended up working in the prison system. So he fell in love with the idea of giving people who have blown it a second chance.
Tell me more about the prison system. That is a really rough crowd to be working with. That takes a really special person to be able to do that.
It is a rough crowd. And it seems rougher than it is.
Tell me about it.
So, we went in and got to know through some relationships, we got to know a unique little cohort of people, which were in this one prison in California called Soledad State Prison, Max Security, there's a group of lifers. And they, you know, they've been there for a while and they're going to be there for a while. They had the most of them had the possibility of parole, but they keep going up to the board and they keep getting rejected. So they, you know, but they were the shot callers, you know, they were the fathers of the prison. And so from a leadership perspective, I knew if I could make a difference with those guys, we could change the whole thing.
And you know, what did you go in there to try to do?
Well, we ended up, I mean, I came in there listening. So I followed some nuns, you know, because Catholics do a bunch of cool restorative justice stuff. I followed some nuns and got to know these guys. And then we were talking about what these guys want. And what they wanted was help. They really wanted help with themselves. You know, they go through these educational things and they got to burn some time anyway. So they're like lots of education stuff and that kind of thing. But at the same time, I met a guy that you've now met named Dan Dakini. Dan, brilliant guy. And had been in the transformational leadership space. I had a consulting company, had been running these trainings, these leadership trainings in the public sphere for, you know, 3 decades at the time, world class at it. And I met him and he on the side had been doing gang intervention work. And so I got to know him and I immediately hit it off with him. Like anybody that meets Dan, he's a fascinating fella, which, you know, And I met him and I thought, okay, what can Dan do? So I hired Dan right away and I brought him in. And he naturally did what he did, which was help set up and facilitate conversations of human transformation, like leadership transformation, healing. There's lots of ways you could talk about it, like healing, reconciliation internally, ownership. I mean, the crux of that, those trainings, we would do these 3-day leadership trainings. The crux of the training is moving from a victim mindset to a responsible mindset.
Yeah.
Which was where most of the pain of these guys was.
How do you do that? So that is the most challenging question in the world, I think. All the people that suffer life's greatest ills are victims in their own mind.
Yes.
As opposed to people that are working the problem.
Yeah.
How do you get someone, and this will bring us into your coaching side, I'm sure, as we're keep moving through this journey. How do you move someone from the wound collecting victim mindset beyond that?
Well, you got to point, you got to teach the fish that he's swimming. Meaning,
got to teach the fish that they're swimming. I love it.
You know, it's, I mean, this, the a mindset in general is invisible to us, right? Like we're in it. Like it's, and we actually call it us, right? Our thinking and our really, I mean, so. You know, results come from actions. We know that either actions or inaction, right? There's a result. And then but all the action comes out of decisions we make or don't make. And all the decisions we make come out of thinking and how we make choices and all our thoughts and our analysis and intuitive and analytical, blah, blah, blah. And all that comes out of our belief system. So when we talk about a victim mindset, that's in the belief system. And so one of the core of our work is first off helping people understand that people relate to the world the way the world occurs to them. Mm-hmm. Like everything is connected to perception. Like we don't get a vote on that. That is neurologically gravity, right? It seems like we're both on the same call right now, but we're not. I'm on my version. You're on your version. There's things you're wondering about that I'm not wondering about, things I'm wondering about that you're not. And now, you know, so we're in this milieu. We're in this environment. That's why I teach a fish that they're swimming. I'm swimming in an environment of my thinking. And most people don't think about how much they're thinking. They don't notice how much they're noticing. And by the way, wondering about why they do it that way. And they don't ponder about it. There's not a lot of self-inquiry. And so to get to your question, how do you get somebody to shift? First off, you got to get them to see. Like, can I see what I'm seeing? And then actually take this heroic journey of saying, I wonder if how I'm seeing it isn't an accident. Like I see it that way. Let's say there's purpose to it. And what is the purpose? And what's the future baked with that purpose? So a victim mindset says the world's happening to me. It happened to me. Like I am happening to me. That person is happening to me, right? It is a natural subjective, or what's the word? Oh, I can't think of the right word to describe it. Like I'm at effect of something else, like the other thing, whatever the other thing is. And this is, welcome to Sigmund Freud, right? Freud said, I am because of, like, right. It's an etiological view, the nerds say, right? Like I am the effect of the cause, and the cause is not me. The cause is something else. And so I spend all my time in a, in a therapist chair wondering about what happened when I was five. Now, no problem, but that's got a whole world baked in it. And the best I can do is overcome what happened. So to get them to, I mean, in these trainings, we would, by the end of day three, or by early day three, we'd already done, we'd broken a lot of stuff up and built rapport and started to challenge ideas and blah, blah, blah. And we do this victim responsible conversation, which would go something like this, where we talk about what does it mean to be a victim? We talk about, and everybody knows what it means to be a victim, blah, blah, blah. And we'd put them in pairs and we'd have them tell the story to their partner, say, why are you here? Why are you in prison? What happened? And they'd tell that story just in a neutral way. And then we'd do go through the victim thing. And I'd say, then we'd say, okay, good. Now tell the same story to the other person, but your job is to convince them that you're the victim. Like convince them. Don't take this easy. Convince them. Be dramatic. Sell it. And then we'd have them do that. And we'd go back and forth. And if partner A convinced you're the victim, stand up and better believe it. Everybody stood up, right? Because we're really good at laying this on thick and saying it's not me, it was Pookie, or it was the drug dealer, or it was my mom, or it's the fact of where I grew up, or blah, blah, blah. That's easy to sell and everybody buys it. But then we'd say, what's it like? What was the experience of being the victim? And what are the answers to that? Small, I'm angry, I'm powerless, there's nothing I can do, I'm stuck, I'm cold, I'm shut down, whatever. There's all these experiences of being a victim. Then we'd say, okay, good. Now tell the same story to your partner, but now let's talk about what it means to be responsible. And we talk about what it means to be responsible, blah, blah, blah. Now your job is to probably go back in time a little bit. Now you have to convince your partner that you were responsible, that you want to be in prison on purpose, that you're responsible for everything that happened. So you got to go back in time. And when you joined the gang, or when you went into that house and you knew it, or when you grabbed the gun that day, or when this happened, or when this happened, that it was your choice, nobody else. It was you. And they would tell the story, usually for the very first time, telling it in that way. And then we let's talk about it. What was your experience? And what was the answer? Freedom. I get it. I'm alive. I'm like, it's easy. It was, you know, maybe a little bit awkward, but man, like I wasn't ashamed anymore. Like I just owned it and it was over. I was out of the story and actually owned results. Mm. And so that's, so part of it is people, you know, it brings up this Kierkegaard quote, men find a level of despair that's tolerable and call that happiness. And that's the victimized mindset is like that. Like it actually doesn't serve us. It just protects us. It doesn't help us. It just, you know, keeps me safe. But if I'm willing to kind of die to my own ego and I just own my shit, I'm actually, you know, there's the old rabbinic saying, the truth is what sets us free. So how do you get people? You just invite them to see it and then you invite them to wear it. And then it, being responsible just feels a lot better. Actually, we have a shot at having integrity. Yeah. If I'm responsible, if I'm a victim, I'll just never have integrity.
Oh, and if we can get the victim mentality out, the world would just be an easier place to live in for everyone.
Amen.
And you got it down about how to start moving people in that direction.
Yeah, it's scary. I mean, taking ownership is more frightening than being a victim. It's just worth it.
Yeah.
You know? So if you call people into courageous action and get them to act out of their best self instead of their kind of practiced mediocre self, over time it's like, okay, I'm actually this guy. I'm that one. I'm not going to go back to who I was before. And that's leadership transformation. So we do that. We do that on a micro and macro scale inside of companies all day long. It might sound weird because we're like in the business consultant guys, but we're going deep, man. Like, because that's where the breakthrough is.
It's calling. I love it. Calling people to courageous action.
Yeah,
that gets us right towards the end here, and that is so. You obviously covered a lot about what you do now. Tell me a little bit more about what you do now and the service you offer.
Yeah, so I've got a phenomenal firm of amazing people. It's called Take New Ground, and we intervene inside the lives of leaders and their organizations. So we're called in to help leaders get really clean and really clear about what they're up to, and get really committed to what they're doing, right? Which is like moving beyond a goals conversation. Let's move it into a commitment conversation. What's actually matters to you? What's this really about, right? And so we get the why really loud and get the who really loud. Like, who the hell am I?
Right.
Because we work with only really ambitious, fast moving, brilliant leaders. And there is still a bit of angst in them that they can't get their best gifts on the table. And that's always a who conversation, like what they've decided about them or what they've, most of their frustrations are with other people. So breaking through to somebody else, like actually building a team that can hang the way they hang and even beyond, really, and like getting the resources to the table. So we spend a lot of time, I spend a lot of time coaching founders, coaching CEOs, coaching C-suite executives. And we come in and do these, you know, we don't do kind of kumbaya-ish retreats or kind of educational, you know, offsites that, of course, we can teach crap, but it just doesn't make it much difference as much as Revelation does, which is like right. What can happen in a moment.
That's another great pithy statement. Go ahead. Keep going. That was great.
You know, and that, so we transform and it always happens through really honest dialogue. So when people get really honest and get real, people step up or they step out, which is usually great. You know, it's like if they don't want to do the work here, great. Like, love you. Let's go find you a pasture you want to go in. So anyway, and then we come in, I've got a great team of high-end experts and we can do everything from mergers and acquisitions to restructuring and org this and that, and, you know, recruitment. Anyway, we can help in every aspect of business, but it's always the core, the lifeblood of every organization is what's able to be talked about. And we open that up, you know, exponentially more than most humans are willing to do.
Unbelievable. And it's easy to see why you are so effective at what you do is because you have a lifetime of reps.
Mm.
What you're born and called to do is spin the thread through your life. And it was given to you by the thread of your parents as well. Yep. So it's you're definitely been on your path and life's journey. Adrian, as our time's running down, what's something that I should have asked you that I didn't ask you that I want to make sure you share with everyone before we leave?
Have I always had this stellar beard? I haven't always had this stellar beard.
No, tell me about your stellar beard.
No, anyway, I've always had some kind of facial hair. What's a better answer to that question? What have you asked me? If people are compelled, what should they do? Go talk to anybody. Go have an honest conversation with anybody. Go do that. That's a big win. If you don't have any kind of coach in your life, go get a coach. And there's lots of them out there. Some of them are stellar. Go find one of those. If you don't know where to go, reach out to us. We love advocating for amazing people. So we'd love any conversation anybody wants to have. And we'll fight for you. Fierce advocacy is our work, you know, so we fight for the best thing and we don't fuck around. Like, we're really here to get something done with love, right? With love. Like, it's like fighting for people is our biggest joy. So we've got lots of opportunities for people depending on what they're looking for and what they want. So,
awesome. And Adrian, where can people go to bring you into their lives?
Well, we've got a podcast of our own, Naked Leadership Podcast. You'll learn a lot there.
And it's the title of this episode, by the way, Naked Leadership.
Naked Leadership. Go check it out. We've got a, you know, life's not fair. It's what you negotiate. We've created a negotiation tool for people to understand their own style, their natural style, and to see the upsides to that and the baked in downsides to that. We've created that free quiz. It takes like 5 minutes. It's negotiation.takenewground.com. Then go take that.
All in the show notes, everyone. Excellent.
And we've got a YouTube channel. You can follow me on Instagram, adrian.k. You know, lots of places. Come find
me. Awesome. And everyone, it's in the show notes as always. Adrian, it's been an honor and a pleasure and a joy listening to this amazing transformational life you've had. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing.
You are a joy, my friend. Thank you. So excited about this relationship.
Yeah, me too. Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Forged by Trust. Remember, if you want to forge trust, it's not how you make people feel about you that matters. It's how you make them feel about themselves. If you're interested in more information about how I can help you forge your own trust building, communication, and interpersonal strategies as a speaker, your coach, or as a trusted advisor for you or your organization, please visit my website at www.peopleformula.com. I'm looking forward to sharing my next Forged by Trust episode with you next week when we do a deep dive and being in the moment with the incredible Neil Malarkey.